This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, we'll get a glimpse of America's history through the lens of women's letters. Our guest is writer and editor Lisa Grunewald. She and her husband, Stephen Adler, are the editors of Women's Letters, America from the Revolutionary War to the Present. The first letter is from Rachel Revere to her husband Paul, not long after his 1775 midnight ride, to warn the British were on their way. The final letter is from Wall Street Journal correspondent Farnaz Fasihi. It is an email written from Baghdad in September of 2004. In between Rachel Revere and Farnaz Fasihi are hundreds of letters, personal and political. History comes alive through these letters. As Grunewald and Adler note in the introduction, women's letters talk. They are monologues, dialogues, diatribes. They are voices fixed on paper. The editors also say women's letters rarely just exchange information. Instead, they tell stories. Let me tell you a bit more about Lisa Grunewald, a former magazine editor. She is the author of four novels, including Whatever Makes You Happy. She and her husband, Stephen Adler, are also the editors of Letters of the Century, America, 1900 to 1999. Both Letters of the Century and Women's Letters are published by the Dial Press. Lisa, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
You're so welcome.
Could we jump right in, like you and your husband, Stephen, have done in the introduction to this collection? And maybe you could share with us just a couple of excerpts from the introduction, from letters that are in the collection, as a way to sort of give listeners a taste, a sense of what lies between the covers of this book.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Difficulty of choosing those letters for the introduction was something that kept us talking back and forth because we had so many favorites, but we did start with the revolution. I should say the book is arranged chronologically, so of course we're at the very beginning with a woman named Anne Halton who describes the battle that's going right next door and says the people in this country who are all furnished with arms and have what they call minute companies in every town, ready to march on any alarm, had a signal, it's supposed, by a light from one of the steeples in town. And when I found this letter, I actually was laughing in the library because I thought, you know, this is exactly the way it was described in every history class I'd ever taken. And yet she actually said, you know, there's a light in one of the steeples in town. One of the things that was great about doing this was reading history as it happened, and that was true also of a letter that described Lincoln's assassination. A woman named Julia Shepherd, who happened to be at Ford's Theater that night, wrote, "The report of a pistol is heard. Is it all in the play? A man leaps from the president's box some 10 feet onto the stage. The truth flashes upon me. Brandishing a dagger, he shrieks out, 'The South is avenged,' and rushes through the scenery. No one stirs. Did you hear what he said, Julia? I believe he has killed the president." That was a particular find. You know, part of doing the research for this book was a treasure hunt, and I had a hard time finding a letter that described the assassination. I thought maybe Mary Todd Lincoln had written something in the days following her husband's death. I didn't really know how to approach it. There were lots of Lincoln collections. And one day I was actually standing in the stacks of Columbia's Butler Library thinking there has to have been somebody who saw Lincoln shot. And honest engine, up on the very, very top shelf, there's a book called We Saw Lincoln Shot. Oh. And it was just a collection of firsthand accounts. So we actually ended up putting two of them in the book because we couldn't choose just one. Some of the things that are in the book are more intimate than those historical events like the assassination and the lighting of the lanterns in the steeples. There's a 1776 letter that we have written by a Massachusetts woman whose name was Christian Barnes, and she described what it was like when a rebel soldier just forced his way into her house. She said, I went in and endeavored to pacify him by every method in my power, but I found it was to no purpose. He still continued to abuse me and said when he had eaten his dinner he would want a horse, and if I did not let him have one, he would blow my brains out. An expression, by the way, that I thought was more modern than this, but it was actually 1776. I should add, as I'm reading a few of these, that we didn't alter the language at all in any of the letters. So if I'm reading something that says, when he had eat his dinner,
right,
because that's how it was written. The Donner Party, the famous trip west of the Donner Expedition, in which many, many men and women were caught in the Sierra Nevada, and some of them were actually forced to resort to cannibalism, was captured in 1847 by a woman named Virginia Reed. She was a teenager on along on the trip, and she is one of the few who survived. I mean, one of the few from a family, all of whose members survived intact. And she wrote to her cousin when she got to California and was safe, "We had to kill little Cash, the dog, and eat him. We ate his entrails and feet and hide and everything about him. There was 15 in the cabin we was in, and half of us had to lay abed all the time. There was 10 starved to death. We was hardly able to walk." It's the kind of thing that, to me anyway, just, as you said at the outset, it just brings it alive. It's one thing to sort of read the facts, even a good description, but when you hear the voice of a woman who actually lived through it, you really feel that you're there. And of course, they didn't know they were, for the most part, they didn't really know they were writing history. There isn't that self-consciousness of that you sometimes find in journal entries or diaries where you think you get the sense that they think that someday maybe someone will read this. This was really conversation, and it just happened to be captured on paper.
Yeah. What comes across to me in so many of these letters is a great intensity.
Yes, I think that that's right. I mean, it was the only way that they could communicate their feelings if they weren't in the same place. And, of course, distances were vast. And when someone wrote a letter, it was because there was no other way to get the feelings across. I mean, this is 18th century, 19th century we're talking about. A lot of the intensity, of course, comes from the fact that we weren't including letters that just say, "Hey, how's the weather up there? And do you think you could send down a, you know, a bay of hail?" We were really going for heightened experience and heightened records of it. But even for that, you get the sense that, I don't know, life was lived more. There was an awareness of its fragility. There was an awareness of its brevity because, of course, for many, many years, it really was a much shorter ride. Children were dying left and right. There was smallpox. There were all the diseases we have now, but so many more. We have some, you know, incredibly touching letters about smallpox in the 18th century, the flu, about which we're hearing so much right now, influenza of 1918, 1919, and how it just devastated the population. Women were just amazing. They are incredible. You read through this and you come away knowing that we've endured so much and we will endure so much more.
Yeah. I would like to now turn to the letter of Rachel Revere to her husband, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first letter in the collection, and I was so strangely moved by it. "My dear, by Dr. Church, I send £125 and beg you will take the best care of yourself and not attempt coming into this town again. And if I have an opportunity of coming or sending out anything or any of the children, I shall do it. Pray keep up your spirits and trust yourself and us in the hands of a good God who will take care of us. 'Tis all my dependence, for vain is the help of man. Adieu. Love from your affectionate R. Revere."
Yeah, it kind of got me too. it's why it starts the book. It puts you there, right there in town. And in fact, this letter and the money that she sent with it later were stolen and didn't get to him. But it was the night that he began his famous midnight ride, and there was his wife. I mean, who knew that? You know, who knew that Paul Revere was married to a woman named Rachel, and that she was looking out for him and sending him a little cash? You know, it's just so human.
Yeah, well, it's more than a little cash. That was a lot of money.
Well, yeah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
the humanness of these women is, I guess, the thing that ultimately made this such a remarkably fun project to work on, and one, incidentally, that I'm going to be missing, you know, for this forever, because it was just such a treat. But finding these women who, it didn't matter whether the year they were living in began with a 1-7, a 1-8, a 1-9, or a 2-0, they're us. They're absolutely us. They had their challenges, and they had their humor, and they had their anger, and all of the pettiness and the grandeur that is part of our experience. I mean, to me, it's hilarious to read an 18th century letter in which a woman is sort of being kind of snarky about the fact that her sister, who's pregnant, is being so lazy that she just can't seem to get around the backyard, or to read a woman castigating her husband for having cheated on her and saying, "I'm going to make it incredibly hot for you and that wench." I mean, the language is a little different, but the experience is so universal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the book is arranged chronologically, as you mentioned, in 9 sections. And at the outset of each, there's a timeline of events. And at the top of every letter is a note providing further context. And in the note that heads Rachel Revere's letter, you note that Dr. Church, alas, you know, when Rachel is sending her husband this letter, "My dear, by Dr. Church I send."
Right.
Dr. Church, alas, was a British spy.
Yeah, too bad.
would you tell us about the research you did in order to give readers, to give us this kind of detail?
I can definitely do it. I will try not to weep as I do it, because the number of facts per square inch in this book was kind of staggering to me. Just terrifying to think what we might or might not have gotten, what we might have gotten wrong along the way. Although I hope and trust that it, having been through 7,000 fact checkers of friends and colleagues, that we got at least some of the bugs out. It every single letter had a story. Every single letter came from either an anthology or a collection or somebody's attic or somebody's mother. Or somebody's computer in the later parts of the book, because of course we include email as well. And so we tried to make as thorough a search, to put as much relevant information as we could into as small a space, and not always successfully. I mean, there are a couple places where we have to say we don't have a clue who this woman was, and we can't tell you how the story ended. And we're terribly sorry, but the letter's great anyway, so here, you know, enjoy it, because we did. There's one letter, for example, I think it's in 1929 or so, that was written. I actually bought this letter on eBay, which is how I found it. It was written by a secretary to the Max Factor Company. And it was written to a woman. It was basically an advertising letter, and it described this strange thing that this company and this great man named Max Factor had just invented called makeup. Of course, makeup had existed for years and years, but Max Factor did this brilliant thing of bringing it from stage and movie into a very accessible form. And so here's this wonderful letter describing this exotic thing called makeup, and we could not for the lives of us find out whether this secretary, which was a person's name with two initials at the beginning, whether this was a man, a woman, a fiction, or what. And finally we just threw up our hands in despair and said, "It's such a funny letter, we've just got to include it." But when we did that, you know, we at least didn't pretend otherwise. So
yeah, a caveat.
Yes, always. As many caveats as possible in a book that's more than 800 pages long.
Yeah. In the introduction, you and your husband write, in the course of our research, we rarely found a document that we thought had been written by a woman, only to get to the end and find that the signature was a man's. How do the letters of men and women differ now that you've done these two collections, the letters of the 20th century and women's letters?
Well, you know, it's funny. The first volume, which was, as you say, 20th century, included letters of both men and women. But the letters of men that were in there, for the most part, were letters that often made history, moved forces, made decisions. You know, we had Harry Truman's letter saying, okay, go ahead and drop the bomb. We had lots of historic documents that, by definition, were written by men. Women, for the most part, in this country, for the longest time, didn't shape history, at least not in such a direct way. And so their letters are more intimate, and they reflect upon what's happening, but they don't show it in action. I mean, they show what's happening in action, but they are not decisive letters in which they say, let's form a committee, let's go to war, let's whatever. And the consequence is that these letters are much more personal, for the most part. I mean, we have letters that are business letters, we have letters that are about medicine, we have letters that are about schooling, and we have letters that are about history, war as it's unfolding. But there's so much more intimate talk. I mean, it's not a revelation that women really know how to talk to one another, talk directly to each other, but you see it, you read it and hear it in these letters, just as you would if you were eavesdropping on a conversation. And it's kind of delightful. I was a little worried, to be honest, that when we set out to do this volume, that we wouldn't find the humor that we found in the 20th century volume. I mean, we really loved some of our little short takes in that first book. And, you know, starting in the middle of the 18th century, or toward the end of the 18th century, rather, we worried a little bit that it would be heavy slogging, and that there was so much death and there was so much war and devastation and piety and earnestness that we would just, you know, our eyelids would close while doing the research, let alone the experience for the reader. Obviously, I wouldn't be saying this unless the punchline was good news. It's not that way at all. I mean, we found that when women wrote to each other, they teased, they bitched, they did all the things that women do when they talk to each other. And it was delightful to find that that was true in the 18th century and the 19th and the 20th as well.
Yeah. There's a letter from the 19th century from Rose Williams to Aletti Mosher.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about advice on contraception.
Right.
This is September 27th, 1885. And Rose is giving some advice to Aletti, a newlywed, or about to be newlywed, on how not to get pregnant. And it was illegal to publish, distribute, or possess information about contraception, thanks to the Comstock Act.
Mm-hmm.
And here is this letter between these two women, and it is full of useful information, and also it's very funny.
Yes. That's the one where she says, I stick out in back more than I do in front?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty great.
And it's on page 399, and Rose says, well, now I should say, and did say, who would have thought it? You better bet I was surprised when I read your letter. You never let a fellow know you even had a fellow. You never sent a piece of your dress as you said you would. You want to know of a sure preventative? Well, plague take it. The best way is for you to sleep in one bed and your man in another, and bet you will laugh and say, you goose, you think I'm going to do that? That's wonderful.
It's so great, and it's so yesterday. I mean, this could have happened yesterday. It could happen today. I think probably my my favorite of all of them, if I had to choose, and it's like choosing a child, but there was one that was written just a few years before that, in around 1881, by a woman who lived in California. And she was writing from a town called Bodie, which was pretty notorious at the time for its street fights and its robberies and killings, a real tough town in California. And she wrote to an officer of the law in Bodie. She wrote, "Kind and respected sir, I see in the paper that a man named John Sipes was attacked and ate up by a bear whose cubs he was trying to get when the she-bear came up and stopped him by eating him in the mountains near your town. What I want to know is, did it kill him dead, or was he only partly ate up? And is he from this place and all about the bear? I don't know, but he is a distant husband of mine. My first husband was of that name, and I supposed he was killed in the war, but the name of the man the bear ate being the same, I thought it might be him after all, and I know if he wasn't killed either in the war or by the bear, for I've been married twice, and there ought to be divorce papers got out by him or me if the bear did not eat him up. If it is him, you will know him by his having six toes on his left foot. He also had a spread eagle tattooed on his front chest and an anchor on his right arm, which you will know him by if the bear did not eat up the signs of it being him. Find out all you can about him without him knowing what it is for. That is, if the bear did not eat him all up. If it did, I don't see as you can do anything, and you needn't to trouble. Please answer back." And then she writes, "P.S. Was the bear killed? Also, was the man married again? And did he have any property worth my laying claim to?" Just love that letter.
Yeah, that is great. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and this afternoon on the program, we're getting a glimpse into our history through the lens of women's letters. Our guest is writer and editor Lisa Grunewald. She and her husband, Stephen Adler, are the editors of Women's Letters, America from the Revolutionary War to the Present. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Do women's perspectives on the big issues change or remain the same over time?
Well, I think it depends, of course, on what you say the big issues are. When it comes to love and romance, I think that although the language they use to speak about it changes somewhat, the emotions are universal and they transcend time. I mean, of course, what women's roles are has changed and evolved over the centuries, thank goodness, but how they talk about their children, how they talk about their husbands and their parents is as fresh today as it was at the time. I think the main change that I noticed doing the book really had to do with both religion and freedom from fear. Sort of a strange thing to say in the wake of 9/11, but because certainly fear is with us and religion is with us. But in the early days of the country, it was really hard to find a letter that didn't begin or end or have somewhere in the middle a discussion of God's grace, God's mercy, God's promise, God's blessings, because everything was about death. I mean, it sounds awful to say it, but there was one letter that says, "Only 7 people died this week. Good news." There was childbirth. There was death of parents in childbirth. There was war. There was smallpox. And so the sense of gratitude that women expressed to God, I mean, to one another about God for having made it through another month, another year, was extraordinary. And the sense of not exactly resignation, but hope and faith that there was a plan and someone was in charge when these horrible things happened and people were attacked or they died or they were killed senselessly, the book talks about tuberculosis, and it talks about breast cancer, and it talks about other forms of cancer and all of the diseases that have gone through these years. And women were, in many cases, really the caretakers, the doctors on hand or the nurses. And so that sense of despair and hope that was given to them by their faith really comes through in the early letters. I find it extraordinarily moving. And later on, there's not exactly a sense of entitlement as much, but there's just such freedom from that, that there is more discussion of, you know, more mundane things. It's not as if there aren't issues and problems that continue. There aren't, you know, there obviously have been wars and illnesses and tragedies, but that early conviction that, you know, we're in this country and we're doing what we are doing because it is God's plan, that's something that really, in my view anyway, changed quite a bit over the years.
Yeah. There is a letter that I'm thinking about in the last section of the book. It is, oh gosh, I knew this was going to happen to me.
You shouldn't worry. It's if I can't remember it, then we should.
It's a very moving letter, which is goes without saying. I mean, but woman to woman. A woman telling a friend of hers in a letter about her two daughters and how different they are from one another. And one of the girls is named Maisie. Do you know the letter that I'm talking about?
It's great. It was written by a woman named Sharon O'Connor, I think. And I think I can find it. It's in the 90s or the late 80s. It's a lovely letter.
I think I might have a post-it. I do. It's
Sharon O'Connor, 733, yes. I think.
Yeah, to Mimi Parker.
Beautiful letter because it really deals with, it kind of captures so much of the awareness of raising children that we're kind of allowed to have now, that attention to detail and the nuances between them. She says at one point in this letter, yesterday we went to the local carnival, a midway, about 5 rides, barrel races, a petting zoo, and cotton candy. It was fun. I took the girls on the merry-go-round and stood between their two horses while it spun around. I held each girl in the small of her back, my almost 5-year-old to my right, my 2-year-old on my left. They bounced up and down like some crazy scale, unable to level out, me in the middle, and somehow it seemed both sweet and melancholy. All I could think of was the days invested in these lives. Maisie is nearing on 2,000 days, Clementine not even 800. When I looked at Maisie, she literally looked to me like she could have floated right off the ride into the clouds.
Mm.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Here's something that must go back forever, you know, a mother's feelings for her children and how different the children are from one another and how, you know, it's like earlier when you were talking about picking a favorite letter, you can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. One of the funny, surprising things is I think there's a letter from, pretty sure it's Jefferson's daughter, Martha. I think it's Martha, in which she's telling him about her children. This is Thomas Jefferson's daughter. And she talks about them very, very frankly, you know, in a way that probably she would prefer them never to know, telling her father which of them is a scholar, who seems a little on the lazy side, you know, who's just all affection and fun. And you're right. There's that wonderful, timeless affection, and also that same. There's a letter in the 19th century of a woman writing to her mother, saying, "You know, it wasn't until I had this child that I realized how much you've done for me and how much you've loved us. And I never understood what real love was until I understood this." That moves me incredibly because I think that, again, these women lived in such different times than we live. I can't imagine them imagining us with our computers and our phones and our ability mm-hmm. even to have this conversation, Celeste. I mean, it would seem unthinkable. But there they were, loving their mothers and their children the same way we do.
Yeah. Well, you know, we started with, one of the letters we started with was Rachel Revere's letter to her husband. And then near the end of the book, there's a very moving communication between a soldier about to go to war in Iraq and his wife. Mm-hmm. And it's the text of an instant message.
Right.
Now, 200 plus years have passed between the Reveres and Lisa and John Knight's communication. And, you know, I found myself wondering, what if Rachel and Paul could have...
could have IM'd each other.
IM'd. But the sense I have of the intensity of the communication is very similar, and it is part and parcel of relationships between people who love one another in a time of great danger.
Absolutely. It brings out so much that's so moving. It's funny about the Internet. You know, so many people have said to Stephen and me as we've been researching both these books now for, well, between the two of them, it's 8 years, amazingly. And they always say, oh, well, good thing that you're doing this now that, you know, emails come along because there won't be letters anymore. And our feeling about that is exactly the opposite, that, well, sure, you know, people aren't dipping pens into ink exactly, but they do use the written word to communicate with one another, and they very often do hit the print button when they receive something that's particularly moving or important. And I think it's kind of wonderful news that that writing, whether it's on a screen or in paper, is back. I mean, people forget that telephone was the real first threat to the written word. And in the same way that it didn't rule out some very, very beautiful letters being written at the turn of that century, email isn't going to harm this, I don't think, anymore. I mean, there's something wonderfully old-fashioned and lovely about sitting down at a desk and writing an actual letter using an actual pen. But the point is there is a record of people's feelings that can survive even the digital age, and I think that's all to the good.
Yeah.
I also have a particular prejudice in favor of the Internet for this because so much of our research couldn't have been done without it. It was just incredibly useful, a way to track these letters down.
Yeah. Tell us about the last letter in the book, which is from a journalist. And it became published, so to speak, on the Internet. And I do have this question for you. Does email and the Internet, do you think that could affect the intimacy, the self-consciousness of what we write to one another?
I think that people are still in the phase of thinking that somehow email is really, really private and that they haven't quite figured out how incredibly unprivate it is. If my teenage daughter is any indication and her friends are any indication of this, I think it's going to take a while before it really sinks in that this stuff is maybe in the ether, but it's not really ephemeral. And it can stick around. So, I don't know. With Fasihi's letter, with her email, clearly she never intended it to be published, and yet she wrote it as a self-conscious, in the best sense, document, knowing that it was going to be seen by a number of her friends, and it was written with a capital W. I mean, this wasn't a mm-hmm. casual offhand comment. It was a real document, a statement of belief, and the fact that it was picked up and published long before we published it must have surprised her, maybe it made people stop and think a little bit. But I think that for the most part, you tend to hit the send button and think that you're never going to see what you've just sent again. Maybe that will change. I don't know.
Yeah. I found myself wondering if she, in writing that letter, was writing, she was writing of the news as she saw it and something that her paper would not publish.
It was something that she was writing privately. I mean, my husband was working for the Wall Street Journal at the time, so it's a little doubly confusing for me to figure it all out. But it wasn't that this letter had been sent to the journal and that the journal had said, nah, we don't want to do it. This was simply a separate, private, here I am reporting to you, my friends, what I'm seeing, in a way that a newspaper, I don't know, she may have just thought it was too intimate.
And it essentially, to give the listeners here a sense of what the letter is about, it is about the danger and the chaos of where she is in Iraq during the war.
Yeah, she was in danger, and I think that's another reason. I mean, the newspaper wasn't, I'm not speaking for the journal here, let me make it clear, but a newspaper by definition isn't necessarily going to say, find it newsworthy that its correspondent is in a dangerous spot. Of course, its correspondent is in a dangerous spot. She was talking as a person to her friends and saying, boy, is this hairy. And I think there's a distinction, but it definitely raised a lot of questions at the time about what was the difference between what was being said privately, not just in her case, but in general, and what was being published. But I don't think you can find any particular nefarious pattern to it. I think it's just one of those things. There's not a lot of nefarious stuff in this book. It's pretty much what it seems to be.
Well, speaking of publication and speaking of women in tough jobs, there are letters here that we hear loud and clear, the struggle to do one's work in a man's world. And I really admired the letter Tina Brown wrote.
I love that letter. I'm so glad you raised it.
Tina Brown wrote to one of her staff writers saying, you know, hey, we don't do this. And if you continue to want to have the office in the New Yorker, you know, you've got to play fair and square.
Yeah, apparently she had gotten wind of the fact that this author, staff writer, had been being somewhat snarky about her and her editorial MO. This was back in, I think,
96. Yeah.
And so she just took him right on. I mean, another boss, another woman, another person in that situation might have just sort of felt wounded and gone under, but not Tina Brown. So she wrote back, it's so much easier to blame me than have a candid and uncomfortable conversation with an in-house writer. The form these days is to play into the old gossip stereotyping. I tried to persuade Tina to run it, but unless it's about Michael Ovitz, she doesn't give a damn. I fought for it. And then she says, what a joke. I often wish in the last 3 years I had a tape recorder in the editorial meetings as editors, quote, fought for pieces they were describing to me as unpublishable garbage. Not mincing her words there.
Mm-mm.
But she was terrific. She stood up, you know, called it like it was, said, I'm not going to take this. This is, you know, this wasn't up to our standards, and I'm not going to let you hide behind these accusations that I'm just being difficult.
Yeah.
Another editor whose letter I love in here is a different Brown, Helen Gurley Brown, who back in 72, The staff of the Harvard Lampoon had decided to put together a parody issue of Cosmopolitan, and it had come up with a cover in which there was a really sort of trashy-looking woman on the cover, and they sent the cover to Helen Gurley Brown for her, not exactly blessing, but for her reaction, and supposedly to make sure that the color scheme of the parody cover was not at all like the cover of the Cosmopolitan issue that was going to be on the stand. And Helen Gurley Brown wrote back, "Dear Eric, as I mentioned in our telephone conversation, our feeling is that Cosmopolitan is such a self-help magazine in many areas that it isn't quite true to us to bear down so heavily on sex in your cover lines. I would hope that you could charge at least, that you could change at least 50% of them. The two I object to most are 10 ways to decorate your uterine wall and turn your period into a dash. I'm enclosing the September issue of Cosmo so you can see how few of our own cover lines are sexy. Regarding the cover illustration, as you know, I think it's just generally not very pretty and won't sell as many magazines for you as something more attractive would. She looks gloomy, which is always a put-off, and I don't think anybody is going to be attracted to that bosom. You have told me how expensive it is to try another cover, but I would hope very much that you might be able to do so. May I hear from you soon?" And she's fabulous, right? And
yeah.
She got her way, too. And I actually talked to, I found the guy who had been the editor-in-chief of the Lampoon at the time. His name is Eric Raymond. And he said that she just was so persuasive. He just bent to her will automatically and, of course, realized that she was totally right, that the smarter way to do the parody was not to have this very trashy woman on the cover, but to have someone who was dressed like the perfect Cosmo girl but had her eyes crossed, which is what he did. And it did, according to him, turn out to be the best-selling Lampoon parody ever. But I loved the way that she handled that. It was just so smooth and no outrage, no hissy fit. Just let me see if I can show you how a different way to look at this.
Let me set you straight, quite frankly. Very matter-of-factly.
Exactly.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. It's just been a pleasure talking with you and dipping into women's letters. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
Lisa Grunewald has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She and her husband, Stephen Adler, are the editors of Women's Letters, America from the Revolutionary War to the Present. They are also the editors of Letters of the Century, America 1900 to 1999, both published by the Dial Press. And that interview was conducted on November 3rd of 2005.